Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to our medical decision making webinar this evening. It is with great pleasure I welcome Suzanne Duff, who is an old age psychiatrist currently based in Waitemata. She's also a resource expert for our GenA725 paper, Reflection in Rural Clinical Practice. This gives Suzanne a clear idea of our context, and we are very grateful for your time and expertise this evening, Suzanne. Secondly, we have Jan Wong, who is a rural hospital medicine specialist and convener of the GenA725 paper, with us to help facilitate and to lend his knowledge to our webinar. Thank you also, Jan, for giving us your time this evening and being here with us. This session is endorsed by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners for 1 hour CME and is supported by the Department of Rural Health General Practice Department at the University of Otago. So now I will hand over to Suzanne to lead us through this webinar. And as we go through, just put questions into the chat and we have points where we're going to ask them. So please engage with us. And we've also got some polls. So we're looking forward to involving you all. Over to you, Suzanne.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lucinda. So this evening we have quite a lot to cover. This is quite a big topic, and I will try and focus the content on the areas of assessment of decision-making capacity that I believe are those that you as rural practitioners, both in rural general practice and rural hospital care, are most likely to face. Why is this important? Why and when might we even think about assessing capacity? And in fact, is it important? Is it something that we should be doing as doctors? I think it is. I think that we have a duty of care. We have a duty of care to our vulnerable patients. And those who lose capacity may become vulnerable to abuse, neglect, or influence. So we have a responsibility to them. Also, those who lose capacity may place themselves and others at risk. So we have a duty of care to protect them and to be asking and considering these questions. When might we need to think about assessing somebody's capacity? We tend to do that in both formal and informal ways. In informal ways, we do it every single day that we're practicing. We are making judgments, we're making micro assessments of people's decision-making capacity in every discussion that we have about consent to treatment. But there are also going to be bigger triggers that will trigger a more formal consideration of the issues and assessment of capacity. And what are those sorts of situations? I think probably the one that raises its ugly head most commonly for us is when we are faced with a situation where somebody is living in an unsafe situation. Can they return home, or in the GP setting, can they stay at home? And these are really tricky judgments to make. We have to consider the fact that on the one hand, there's the decision about whether or not it's a safe thing. And on the other hand, there's the issue of their capacity to make that decision for themselves. And I think sometimes we get ourselves a bit tied in knots and a bit confused about which aspect we're looking at, because they're not the same thing. If someone's refusing treatment, we have to consider consent issues. The other time when you may, as a health practitioner, be asked to consider somebody's capacity is whether they hold the capacity to appoint an enduring power of attorney, or occasionally whether they hold testamentary capacity, which is the legal term for being capable of making a will. Enduring power of attorney is a two-step process. So you may also then, as a practitioner, be asked to make an expert statement on whether somebody's enduring power of attorney needs to be activated, or whether the proxy decision-making, the attorney that's been chosen, needs to be told that now is the time for them to start to make decisions on behalf of that person. What we shouldn't be doing is making assumptions and doing assessments of capacity in a just-in-case sort of a way, just because people have a diagnosis of a dementia or a cognitive impairment of another nature. And then we're brought to think about, well, who should be doing that assessment and when should it occur? These are big issues. These are crisis points in people's lives. And we want to try and make these assessments at times when they're in the best possible state to make them, rather than in times of crisis. And who is the best person to make these assessments? Really, general practitioners and doctors who have a longitudinal relationship with people are in a much better position to make judgments on whether decisions that someone is making are, for instance, consistent with how they've always made decisions. Is this a person who's always made bad decisions? You're also in the really good position of knowing a person already and having trust and an alliance and a relationship with that person, which will be valuable in your assessment. However, the flip side of that is that I think people worry, not without good reason, that making an assessment of decision-making capacity and telling a person something that they may not want to hear may have really bad impacts upon that therapeutic alliance and really bad impacts upon that trust and relationship. And you might sometimes feel that it would be better and easier for instance, a hospital doctor who's going to have short-term contact with someone to make that judgment call, to be the bad cop, and for you to come back into the picture as a general practitioner down the line. So, you know, none of this is set in concrete. It's all very fluid and there are no right or wrongs, I'm afraid. So those of you that wanted, you know, absolute right or wrongs, you might as well just head off and get a cup of tea now, because I don't know whether I'm going to answer those for you. So all of this is about judgment call. And that's what makes it really tricky, I think. So what is capacity? Capacity is a legal, clinical, ethical, and social construct. It's the ability of an individual to make autonomous choices. And everyone is assumed to be autonomous and capable of making their own decisions, to have decision-making capacity until proven otherwise. Capacity is not a general thing. It's task and decision specific. So I may hold the capacity to make a decision about X because it's simple, but not Y because it's more complex. When we assess people's decision-making capacity, we want to focus on the process of how they're making decisions rather than the content of that decision, i.e., capable, autonomous individuals are entitled and in fact must be respected and allowed to make bad decisions, even those, heaven forbid, if they dare to, that are different decisions to those of their doctors. So don't get caught up on whether or not you agree, whether or not the person is making the decision that those around them are making, but focus more on how they're making that decision. And if it's a different decision to that everybody else seems to think, what is the reasoning behind that? And why is that position being held? As I said before, this is all done on a balance of probabilities. You'll do your assessment and you'll come to the conclusion that on the balance of probabilities, this person appears to lack decision-making capacity in this area. But all we can do is give an opinion, back that opinion up with reasonable evidence, but it's not a black or white, you know, 100%. And what you'll find is that different clinicians hold different views on these things. And within the subspecialties, different clinicians will hold different views. I will hold different views to some of my colleagues in any one given situation, and that can be problematic. In fact, can occasionally cause things to have to come before the court because there's a difference of opinion. Decision-making capacity will also vary over time. I do not have decision-making capacity when I'm jet-lagged and have just got off a long-haul flight from the UK. All sorts of things can affect our ability to make competent decisions. And it's not diagnosis-dependent. dementia does not equal loss of decision-making capacity. A score of 18 on 30 on a mini ACE does not equal loss of decision-making capacity. A diagnosis of long-term schizophrenia and chronic delusions do not necessarily make a definite outcome inevitability of not having decision-making capacity. And it's really important to remember that these things are culturally and socially mediated and vary between cultures. So the sorts of things to think about culturally, you know, are you dealing with someone who comes from a culture where there is a very individual view of life and decision-making and the rights of the individual? Or are you dealing with somebody who comes from a culture where there's much more of a collective understanding, the needs of the collective being greater than the needs of the individual, for instance? They will make decisions differently and they will arrive at different conclusions. And for Māori, the importance of whakawhanungatanga, the consideration of what this process is going to do for the person, what the potential impact on this process, that this process will have on their mana. These are important things. And more in New Zealand as well, we need to be thinking and considering about tensions between generations, different expectations of different generations coming through. People are going to view the world differently and draw different conclusions. And it becomes really complex. The person who just keeps saying in a very black and white way, I can go home because my daughter will care for me. And the daughter's trying to say, I can't provide the care that you need. I'm not able to do that. I have other commitments. Can that person adapt and bring that information on board, or do they just keep stating again, this is what I want, this is what should happen? When does that become a decision that's lacking in capacity? This slide really is just to reassure people, I suppose, that there's quite a lot of grey areas and confusion between capacity and competency. They're two terms that get thrown about interchangeably, and I wouldn't get too caught up on it. Competency is much more of a US terminology, capacity much more so in the Commonwealth countries. And then don't forget about assent. That's a person who's lacking in capacity but who agrees with a decision. I'll come on to talk a little bit more about that later. So one of the ways that it's quite nice to conceptualize decision-making capacity, this isn't necessarily a formalized process to work through, but it's just quite a nice little reminder for you, things to consider. I like to think about the five C's of decision-making capacity. Does the person know the context of the decision at hand? Does the person know the choices that are available to them? Do they appreciate the consequences of specific choices and the consequences of the decisions that they're making? Are they consistent in the decisions that they're making? And can they communicate their decisions or choices? Now, I referred a few minutes ago to the fact that you can have assent, which is not the same as consent. Now, there's this concept of the asymmetry problem. Basically, what that means is that potentially patients can lack capacity to make decisions against medical recommendations, but have capacity to make decisions aligned with medical recommendations. Now, that on the face of it sounds like a bit of a double standard on our part. But the reason for that is that if the decision that you're making runs a greater risk of harm, or if the issue that you're facing is complex, then the level of cognitive ability that you need to make that decision is greater. And the level to which we need to ask ourselves, is this person truly, really weighing and using information and making this decision? If the decision is high risk, we need to work harder to be sure that that is a competent decision. And then once we've become sure that it's a competent decision, we have to back off and leave the person be to make that decision. These are not easy assessments to make. And it's something of a sliding scale that the more cognitively impaired somebody is, the more complex a situation is, the more conflict and dissent there is within a person's social context, perhaps within their family or their family, the more risk there is of coercion or undue influence, and the greater potential for significant harm, the more thoroughly we have to properly ask ourselves, is this decision competent? Does this person hold the capacity to make this decision? Getting on to the how-to. So somebody says to you, I think that this person needs a capacity assessment. Well, first thing you need to do is actually ask yourself, is that reasonable? Is that valid? Should I be questioning this decision at all? Should I be questioning this person's ability to make decisions at all? Do I have jurisdiction, as it were? And do I properly understand? Do I have a concept in my own head what aspects of decision-making capacity I am assessing? I'm not assessing whether somebody is safe to go home or not. I'm assessing whether they have the capacity to make the decision to go home or not. And then I'm deciding, if they don't, what am I going to do about that? What recommendations am I going to make? What are my next steps? So in order to get a clear idea in your head about what you're assessing, you need to gather information before you even start. You need to know what you're doing. You need to know what the risks are, what the potential choices are. If you don't know what they are, you can't get any kind of idea as to whether or not the person is weighing that information in a balanced and reasonable way. And you're also duty bound, ethically bound, to ensure that all steps have been taken to optimize decision-making capacity. So you'd like to think that you wouldn't be trying to make a decision as to whether or not Mrs. Jones is competent to return home until you've treated her delirium, for instance. I mean, that's a kind of extreme example, but you know,
yeah,
you got to wait. So the ways that we might optimize capacity are things like choosing the right time of day, ensuring that people have the necessary supports around them, but being mindful of the fact that people present during an assessment may in fact exert some influence. How are you going to provide information? So again, a simple example might be a person's capacity to consent to treatment. How are you going to provide them with the information about that treatment? Do you have written information available in understandable language that you can present to a person in small chunks? Do you need an interpreter? Do you have information, or do you have somebody who speaks their language who can assist you with this process? Have you ensured that communication aids are available? I went to work in Ward 12 one day, which is our assessing ward, without my reading glasses, and I couldn't do my job. You know, it had marked impact on my capacity. I could not do my job. And so I went to the nurse's station and I said, do we have any spare reading glasses here? I can't do my job. I've left my glasses at home. And they said, no, we don't. And then we all went, oh my God, that's terrible. We're an inpatient old age psychiatry ward and we do not have spare reading glasses. We do now. So hearing aids, glasses, you've got to do what you can to give the person the opportunity to function at their optimal, whilst also bearing in mind the fact that if this is a person who never, ever, ever puts their hearing aids in at home, that is going to have an impact on how they're doing at home. You do need to attempt to gain consent, particularly when you're doing assessments for reports for the court. And I would caution people that, you know, we can We sometimes gather a lot of information informally, and we've almost made a decision before having a formal interview as such. But it's really important to afford the person the opportunity to know what is happening. It's really important to try to have a conversation with someone, no matter how cognitively impaired they are, about the fact that you're there today to talk with them about whether they are able to make their own decisions or whether they're needing some help from other people to make safe decisions. If they refuse consent, well, that's part of your assessment. That's part of someone understanding, when I was saying the C, the context of the problem. So saying no is, you know, it's not a good start. If you don't get it, that this is important, then that's all information that you'll bear in mind. And so in order to make an autonomous decision, a person needs to have sufficient information to make the decision, and you have an obligation to provide that. The decision needs to be made free of coercion or influence. So you need to be sure that they've had an opportunity to express a choice both with and without others present. And then they need the mental capacity to make that decision. Over the course of your assessment, quite a nice way of breaking it down is into these four areas. By the end of your assessment process, and only a small part of that will be the interview, a lot of that will be the information gathering, you want to ask yourself, does the person understand the nature and purpose of a decision? That's the context. Do they demonstrate that they can retain relevant information essential for making a diagnosis? Now, they don't necessarily need to retain it for terribly long. And again, depending on the complexity of the decision and the risk involved, you may still feel that someone who doesn't retain for very long still holds capacity if every single time you ask the same questions, a bit like Groundhog Day, isn't it? But if every time you sit down to have this discussion and present this information, if that person consistently comes to the same decision each time that issue is discussed, even if they don't remember that they had that discussion with you the day before, there are reasonable grounds to say that that is a competent decision. And I think that the area where you're most likely to come up against that kind of situation is when you're asked whether a person has capacity to appoint enduring power of attorney. And sometimes people who have quite a marked memory impairment will know the concept of what an enduring power of attorney is, and they will consistently choose the same person, come to the same decision when asked about it on separate occasions. So this is why sometimes you'll make an assessment based on one interview, but actually sometimes it's two or three interviews that will help you to get a handle on whether people are being consistent in their decision making. Can they use and weigh the relevant information as part of a reasoning process and consider the consequences of their options? And can they communicate their decisions? So if you've got a profound aphasia following a massive stroke, that is going to affect your decision-making capacity. Because if you cannot articulate your choices, then you cannot be deemed to be competent to make decisions. So this is just kind of how you would go about it. Asking what the person knows about a situation. Starting, you know, a good example, because I think this is probably what you will face the most commonly. If you're doing an assessment of a person's capacity to appoint enduring power of attorney, can you tell me what you know about enduring power of attorney? So what does the person know already? Ask open questions, then provide information and ask the person to paraphrase back to you the information that you've just given them. then begin to ask more closed questions regarding specific areas. I'm interested to know why you would choose your son rather than your daughter. What are their answers to that? What is the reasoning for that? And this may all take more than one interview. So in order to demonstrate understanding of an issue, understanding of the decision that faces them, they need to be able to kind of tell you what the decision is in the first place, why it's important, why is it important now, what alternatives are there, including the option of making no decision, and why are other people worried? I wonder why the nurses feel differently. The occupational therapist is concerned that you'll be safe when you go home. What do you think? What can you tell me about why you feel so differently, for instance? But it's not, you know, it's not, don't set the bar too high in terms of people's sophistication in their information processing. Can they weigh up the risks and benefits of each choice? Just repeating the same, this is what I want, over and over again, without being able at all to weigh up, measure that choice against other choices, is terribly narrow reasoning. And particularly, can they assimilate new information? So that's kind of what I was saying about, you know, the person who just keeps saying, well, my daughter will look after me, my daughter will look after me. Well, your daughter's out working all day. So how do you think you'll cope when there's nobody at home? My daughter will look after me. For instance, that's a kind of extreme example of somebody not able to bring in new information and adjust or change their decision-making style accordingly. And if you deny that there's a problem at all, if you cannot grasp the underlying issue, then it's very likely that you do not hold decision-making capacity, because every subsequent decision that you make will be based upon that initial faulty premise. Do you think you're safe to go, you know, to go home? Yes, of course. What about the worries of others? They have no, there are no worries. I have no problems at home. I had problems at home, but now I'm fine. What's changed? I'm just fine. Again, if you don't get it why others are worried about you, it's quite unlikely that you're able to really properly weigh up the risks associated with the different choices that you might be able to take. But this is not as simple as it sounds. And you all know that from clinical experience, because we all make decisions in different ways. And some people have a lifetime of making very rapid, very black and white decisions based on very little information and not taking into account the opinions or worries of others. And if you've always made decisions that way and you continue to make decisions that way, then it's not necessarily that you've lost decision-making capacity. So it's really important to talk with other people about, how has your dad made decisions in the past? Is this typical for him, or is this different in some way? And that's where, if you're a general practitioner, for instance, and you have a long relationship with someone, you're in a better position to be able to make that kind of a judgment. But that can be hard as well, because we can get a little bit like the frog in the saucepan, where the water's getting hotter, but it doesn't really realize it because it's getting used to it. And sometimes when we've been used to a certain style of decision-making, we then also don't recognize that it's changed due to greater memory impairment superimposed on the very concrete black and white bugger the lot approach to decision-making that they previously employed. So at this stage, before we go on to consider a wee clinical case, are there any questions or issues that have come up in the chat, Jan, that we should spend some time talking about?
Just saying, I think everyone's captivated, but so no one's put up any questions, but I do have one myself.
Excellent.
That's okay. You're talking about optimizing the patient's condition before we do the assessment, and use delirium as an example. And
Yes.
it's quite not uncommonly we deal with delirium in rural hospital settings, and delirium can
Yes.
take a long time to resolve. And in the meantime, everything else starting to resolve, and we need to find a place for this person to go. And how do we go around working on discharge planning? We can't do assessment, and we don't think there's a safe place for the person to go to.
It's really hard, isn't it? And we are so often stuck between a rock and a hard place in terms of truly meeting our ethical responsibilities to somebody versus working within the constraints of the system that operates around us. We can't keep people in hospital for weeks or months waiting for the delirium to resolve. You're absolutely right. And of course, for many people, it will partially resolve, but they'll never get back to their true baseline. So the chances are they may not regain decision-making capacity anyway. But in all of this, you have the ability to make a judgment on whether you think the mental incapacity, the decision-making incapacity, is going to be long-term or short-term. And you have the ability to make a judgment on whether you feel that there's any chance of the person regaining decision-making capacity. And if you feel really strongly that there's a good chance that they might, you can make recommendations to the court, or if it's an activation of an enduring power of attorney, you can make a recommendation that it is activated for 3 months or activated for 6 months. Or that the welfare guardianship order is reviewed at 1 year, just in case the person has regained capacity. And then
Yeah,
do
I
your
see.
discharge planning based around that. Though, of course, everything else becomes more problematic then in that they lose their accommodation and this, that, the next thing. And, it's hard. So we've
Thank you,
got a
Susan.
case. So,
There is another question,
yeah, go
Susan.
on.
This is from Alex. He asked whether the lawyers would go through similar process when they're preparing a power attorney document
That's
with the
a
family.
really good question, and I'm going to go into the appointment of EPOA in some detail slightly later. Should we come back to that question, Alex? Because it's a really important one. So we've got a wee clinical case. So Mrs. Nola is an 82-year-old Croatian woman who was admitted to the rural hospital following a fall at home. She has an established diagnosis of a vascular dementia. There's growing concern from the community nurses and the GP that she's not safe to live alone, but she wishes to return home. This will be a really common scenario for a lot of people. So obviously in this forum, we're not able to have a discussion of this, but I want you to be thinking about what are the issues related to this situation in this case? Are there even grounds at all for capacity assessment? Who should be doing it? I alluded to that earlier, hospital doctors, general practitioners. If so, what aspect of decision-making capacity needs to be assessed, and what might the possible outcomes be? So, for instance, if you assess a person's ability to make the decision to go home alone, and you decide that that is not a competent decision, that they are not fully understanding that context and not able to use and weigh information in a way that demonstrates to you that that is a competent decision, that's only step one, isn't it? Then step two is, what am I going to do about that situation? Do we need to be activating enduring powers of attorney if they have them? Wouldn't that be nice? Do we have to be thinking about an application to the court for a triple PNR order for welfare guardianship so that somebody becomes the proxy decision-making in the absence of an enduring power of attorney? And even once you've done all that, sometimes we're in situations where once you can appoint the proxy decision-maker, the proxy decision-maker can make safe the home situation and the follow-up plan so that Mrs. Nola net gets to go home after all, because the supports can be put in place by others. that will allow her to be safer at home. Whereas when she was doggedly saying, I will go home and not accept any supports, then it might have looked last week like the only option was going to be residential care. So the information in the notes indicates that she lives at home, which is dilapidated and dirty. She's doubly incontinent, very little food in the cupboards. She's refusing to take the warfarin prescribed following a heart replacement surgery. In the recent past, she's refused all external help and is insisting that she's coping. And it appears that there may be some disagreement within her family about the best course of action. The OT, physio, and nursing staff on the ward are of the opinion that she is no longer safe to live alone at home. One of her daughters has asked to be present during the assessment. I'm wondering whether people would consent to that or have concerns about that. My approach generally is that I try to do both. If somebody wants to be present at the assessment, then I invite them in. But I also explain that it's really important in this assessment process that the patient is given the opportunity to see me alone as well. And the reason I do that is because people may be in a situation where they're being coerced or influenced. There may be other factors at play, like financial gain that puts pressure on people to stay at home or whatever. You may not be aware that you're in a situation like that with the other person. So I absolutely agree to people coming in and joining us because you want to be working together to find a solution. But I absolutely ensure that I get the opportunity to see somebody on their own as well. If a family member said that they didn't want me to see their relative alone, that would ring warning bells for me and red flags for me that all was not as it seemed. So when you meet with her, Mrs. Nola tells you that she wants to return home. Being with her dog is the most important consideration for her. She acknowledges previous difficulties with the home environment, but states that she now feels better after rehabilitation on the ward and will be able to cope at home without supports. She appears during the course of your discussion to minimise her difficulties or the concerns of others and is very vague regarding the circumstances of her admission and how bad things had got. She states that she's opposed to rest home care, citing cost, the fact that the staff and residents are likely not to speak her native language, and she cannot otherwise cite any possible advantages or disadvantages to either accommodation option. So with that information on board, you're starting to form a judgment as to whether or not a person, whether she's making a competent decision, whether she has the decision-making capacity to choose where she lives. And you may still feel that you need more information. So finally, you get to the stage where, no, I have got enough information and I have to commit, I have to put my money where my mouth is and make a judgment on this. I've seen her many times. I've spoken to a lot of people. I've seen her with or without her family. And now I have to make a decision. I adhered before to the fact that just because somebody lacks decision-making capacity doesn't inevitably mean that their choices are overridden. Quite the opposite. The appointment of a proxy decision-maker may, in actual fact, facilitate the support of the outcome that they wanted, even though they weren't capable of making that decision themselves. And then you decide what to do next. So you've done your assessment. You've come to your conclusions. I alluded earlier to the fact that there are kind of two contexts in which we do these assessments. One is informal, where there isn't going to need to be any legal process. It's not about enduring power of attorney. It's not about triple PNR process, but it's about understanding of treatment choices or outcomes or whatever. Those are informal assessments and can be documented in the clinical notes. I suggest that you know, if anyone's got any degree of cognitive impairment, that you think about how you document that informed choice and how you briefly cover the areas that we've covered already tonight in documenting why you felt that a person had capacity to consent to treatment, for instance. And then there's the more formal assessments, where a more formal report needs to be written. Now, I do have a Word document of this information on the slides that can be sent out to you after this webinar. So, you know, because there's quite a lot of information here, but this just gives you some idea of how to set out your reports for the court or how to write a certificate for activation of an enduring power of attorney, because that's kind of the two routes. I'll explain that shortly. So there's the thing about doing medical legal reports is you have to understand the terminology that they want. The court wants to know your expertise. They want to know your job role. They want to know your training. They want to know who you are and what you do. And they want to know that assessment of decision-making capacity, quote, is within my scope of practice. So they want to know that people who are doing these reports have at least attempted to upskill in that area and be familiar with these kind of concepts. And so you don't have to have done any formal postgraduate training. Attending a webinar like this, for instance, would give you the training and the background to be able to say, yes, this is part of my scope of practice. It doesn't mean that you have to be a specialist. And then various bits and pieces of information about your relationship with the patient, how long you've known them, the context in which you interviewed them, when you interviewed them, the sources of information. If you spoke to people, who did you speak to? If you read notes, what notes did you read? If you relied on an assessment by a physio or by an OT, what was that? And then some information about the conditions that they've got that you think are directly impacting upon decision-making capacity. And most commonly, that will be a dementia of some sort, although sometimes it's a chronic psychotic illness. And their general state of medical health, because that's going to have an impact upon the risks associated with the context and how high you set the bar. And then you want to tell the court some basic background information about risks and safety concerns and why there is jurisdiction for assessing capacity in the first place. And then you want a little bit of information about the patient's understanding of the situation, and then you can compare the concerns of others to the concerns of the patient, and that will help to round out your assessment. Comment on their mental state and comment on any cognitive testing or multidisciplinary team assessments if they've been done. But it's really important to remember that just a number means nothing. You can have someone who scores 25 on 30 on a mini ACE who has really, really poor executive functioning and really, really poor ability to process information and assimilate new information and weigh up pros and cons, who does not have decision-making capacity. So a number means nothing. And if you are going to quote a number or an assessment scale, give a very brief explanation as to what that is and what it means. So they scored 18 on 30 on the mini ACE assessment scale, which is a basic screening tool for cognitive impairment. And they have deficits in memory, orientation, and problem solving. So that the court, again, your report is an expert witness. And then think about those four areas that I referred to before about understanding, retaining, using and weighing, and communicating. And one of the most useful things that you can do is quote. So if you can put direct quotes in, then that's going to be really powerful. So one night you're called to the hospital by the nursing staff. Things have moved on for Mrs. Nola. She's confused and agitated, and she's trying to leave the hospital. Her family can't be contacted. The nurse asks if the Mental Health Act should be used in order to keep her in hospital. And I think we've got a poll here.
Share results.
Okay. So the majority of people in the audience are feeling that they wouldn't use the Mental Health Act in this situation. And by and large, that's generally the approach that we would take. There's another piece of legislation that allows us to act in situations like this, and that is Right 7.4 of the Health and Disability Code. So what this does is it codifies the concept of necessity and duty of care, and it authorizes clinical staff to provide care for a person lacking confidence if those staff are acting in the person's best interests and have attempted to ascertain the views of the person or their supporters. It can be used in emergency situations, but not in the longer term. So when you're facing a situation where you need to make safe a person who, in the acute setting, has a lack of decision-making capacity and is not consenting to treatment, you can go ahead and treat under duty of care using Right 7.4. So we wouldn't generally feel that we needed to use the Mental Health Act over and above that. Okay, so I've referred a lot to the Triple PNR Act. Triple PNR Act is the piece of legislation that allows the appointment of proxy decision makers for those who now lack the capacity to make decisions for themselves. And the main areas that you're likely to come up against are enduring powers of attorney, property managers, welfare guardians, and personal orders. Now we have another poll. Power of attorney, in this audience tonight, tell us if you have appointed for yourself enduring powers of attorney. You done that? Okay.
I haven't answered that. I have one.
That's probably quite an accurate reflection, actually. In fact, because we're a bunch of health professionals working in this area, I would hazard a guess that there's more people replying yes to that than there might be in a poll from the general population. It is really important that we all do this. Enduring powers of attorney are the thing that you do before the horse is bolted. It's a two-step process. You choose the person that you want to appoint, and then perhaps years down the track, that person needs to step in when you lose capacity, and your enduring power of attorney is what we call activated. So coming back to Alex's question, there is no legal requirement for a medical assessment of capacity when you appoint a power of attorney, when you do the paperwork to choose the person that you want to be your attorney for either welfare or property. But the lawyer or witness who is overseeing that process has the requirement to make their own informal assessment of that capacity. And if they suspect that there is a problem and that you lack capacity, then they are duty bound to advise you to seek a formal opinion of that. But there is that there is no need for doctors to get involved at this point in the process. And you can appoint for both welfare and for property. And you can have more than one person for your property, but only one person for your welfare. And if you're thinking of doing it for yourselves, think about appointing successors as well, because the person that we've appointed may, in actual fact, lose capacity before we do. So think about the next generation down or whatever in terms of succession planning. So you've done all that, and then the time comes that it has to be activated, go has to be pressed. And this does require assessment by a health professional who has the assessment of decision-making capacity within your scope of practice. And to make that assumption, you would, again, follow the headings that I outlined in those last slides.
Susan, there was a question. There
Yes.
was a question earlier, where did certificate of activation needs to be in a prescribed form, or whether it just needs to contain the
No,
information
it just needs
that
to
you
contain the
described
information.
earlier?
There was the requirement for it to be on prescribed forms a few years ago, but that's been dropped. As long as it contains the information outlined, then that's sufficient. If the horse is bolted and a person has already lost capacity, then they can't sign enduring power of attorney. And in that instance, an application has to go to the court for appointment of welfare guardianship or property management. Now, I have to reassure people that in all the years I've been doing this, I have never been asked to attend the court in person to give expert witness. The report that I have provided to the court has always been sufficient. So I think sometimes people feel a little wary of doing this kind of work because they're concerned they may have to go to court, that that would be a stressful process, that it takes up loads of time. But in actual fact, it happens very rarely. Property management is the property arm of the, so you have welfare guardianship and property management for those who need to have proxy decision makers appointed who've lost the ability to do it themselves. And personal orders, I think, is starting to drill down into more detail, probably than you will require in most of your practice. Thing to bear in mind about personal orders is that personal orders are very much more prescribed. It only relates to one issue, living arrangements, for instance, or medical consent to treatment. So, because it's not a global decision power, but it's a very specific decision power, the courts are sometimes more willing to hear these and push them through quickly with less due diligence. And so sometimes, if Jan, you've got your person who's sitting in the ward and really needs to go to care, sometimes asking the court just to hear an application for a personal order for placement into care rather than a welfare guardianship order, or if you're in a situation where there just isn't anyone who can be a welfare guardian who's willing to step up to that plate, then you can ask the court to make just a personal order for placement. So I'm aware time-wise
Thanks.
that we're almost at our hour. We're actually almost at the end. So I'm just going to throw one other little curly one at you and do our last poll. You're asked again to see Mrs. Nola because she's now requiring care in a specialist dementia unit, a locked specialist dementia unit. And you've been told that she's going to need an enduring power of attorney or a welfare guardian in order to go there. But her granddaughter pops up and says, well, why can't she go under Right 7.4? So our poll question for you is, can a person enter secure dementia care without an enduring power of attorney or welfare guardianship or personal order directing them into residential care? Could you use Right 7.4? Or could you just go along with assent? In this example, Mrs. Nola is saying, oh, well, I'll go then into secure dementia care. Do you think that that can be allowed to occur?
Ooh, it's a bit of a split one.
It's almost a 50-50. So residential care, open, not secure residential care, does not require either an activated enduring power of attorney or an active welfare guardianship order or a residential placement order. But unfortunately, secure dementia care does. And there's a lot of case law these days, both in New Zealand and in the United Kingdom, that clearly now states that you cannot admit somebody who is unable to give fully informed consent to what you're doing to a secure facility that deprives them of their basic human rights of freedom of movement without having a formal structure in place. So, in terms of getting people moving, just to let you know, if you get stuck with this in your rural hospital, What we do in the hospital setting is that once an application has been lodged with the court, and once a person has a number with the court for the application and an appointed lawyer, so they've got oversight, they're in the system, that there are checks and balances and oversight, then we will facilitate discharge from the hospital because the process is underway, but not before then. And finally, the one last thing that we wanted to touch on was advanced directives. So poor old Mrs. Nola deteriorates. Oxygen goes down to 80% sats on room air. She can't talk or communicate, and her family can't be contacted. The family had previously brought in an advanced directive that she wrote 18 months ago. Amongst other things, it states that she does not want to have any life-prolonging treatment, including antibiotics, if she were to develop a life-threatening condition and be suffering from a significant dementia. The advance directive was drawn up with the help of a GP who stated that they felt she had the capacity to make decisions regarding all matters that were contained in the advance directive at the time that it was written. And the signing of the directive was witnessed by a third party. It also specified that it should be reviewed or renewed every 2 years. So that's a pretty damn good advance directive. That is somebody who has done things thoroughly with a GP who was really on board with understanding how to make an advance directive as comprehensive and watertight as possible, so that those facing the very situation that the advance directive refers to feel confident and comfortable in allowing the wishes of the advance directive to be carried through. So an advance directive is much more likely to be observed and binding if it's really specific about the circumstances and situations in which it applies, that it's witnessed, that there's a comment or statement made about capacity at the time that it's drawn up, that there's a relatively short time between when it was drawn up and when the real situation occurs, and built into it was the encouragement that it be reviewed on a regular basis. So in this instance, with that thorough advance directive being written in that way, and this now being the circumstances that I faced as a clinician, I feel that that advance directive should be supported. We may all have differing opinions on that. And that's it. These resources are clickable, and you'll get access, I think, to these links after the webinar that give you just a little bit more detailed information. This toolkit for assessing capacity is fantastic. The link goes through to an online version, and those of you who are really keen, there's a textbook that kind of spells it all out in much more detail than I've covered today. And the videos are some of my colleagues from Otago who've made some videos on process.
I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
So one question, and this is just a clarification point, is that obviously we talked about if someone has an aphasia and can't communicate orally, but if they could communicate in the written form, or if, say, someone is deaf or blind, just in terms of different ways to communicate, they're all acceptable, aren't they? Signage
Absolutely.
is
And
your.
that comes down to optimizing, doing all you can to facilitate decision making for that person and supportive decision making. So doing all you can to support them to make decisions for themselves. So yes, if they can spell things out letter by letter, the process is going to take a long time, but you owe it to them to do that, yes.
That brings me up to the next point about the time, because my take of this is like obviously there's potentially repeated, because you mentioned around when I see them again and they make the same decision, or, you know, and obviously a lot of us, well, I think of particularly in my current working environment where I'm a GP and it takes about 3 to 4 weeks to see me, that to then get people to come back over and over to potentially discuss things. And also on some of the other things that I've been reading, that it's very difficult to do an assessment in your 15 minutes, and it would actually be doing yourself and your patient a disservice or
Yes.
your client.
Yes.
So just around that, how often could you make the decision on a capacity, say a quick 15-minute, half-hour assessment? I suspect it depends on the complexity of the decision.
Yes, so it's that sliding scale, isn't it? It depends on
Yep.
the complexity of the situation and the degree of cognitive impairment.
So everyone just
So kind of
realize.
at both ends of the spectrum, people who have got very advanced disease, you can
Yes.
probably make a judgment more quickly because it's kind of
Yep.
more obvious. And people who have very early disease, who very obviously still
Can.
can retain and weigh information, they're going to be relatively easy and quick. And then the people with moderate impairment, they're the ones where it's going to get more complicated.
More grey.
Yeah.
I think the coercion, that's probably one of the things I fear the most missing. So have you got, like you mentioned that thing, if coercion before, and have you found that you've detected it by seeing the patient by themselves? Like, have they voiced it to you? Like, has that been pretty successful, or?
No is the answer to that. It's more often than not been other members of the MDT have over observing micro interactions in different contexts come to that conclusion and raised concerns rather than it being something that gets disclosed.
That's good. So it just highlights the importance of gathering information and getting collateral history and talking to other people, doesn't it?
And the importance of other people within your team, even from receptionists and front desk people down to, it can be really surprising how much people in the non-clinical roles can pick up vibes.
Yeah.
Sometimes perhaps because people are less guarded
Yeah.
in the waiting room
Yes.
than they
Yes.
are in when they're on the best behaviour in the consultation, for instance.
Thank you. Do you want to ask that one, Jan?
Yes, so Sam, this is from Glenn. I'll just read it out. Is there an avenue to challenge decisions made by an EPOA that don't seem to be in the best interest of the patient?
Yes, that's a really important point. So, those in the role of both enduring power of attorney and welfare guardian have an obligation written in to that role to act in the patient's best interests and to support, wherever possible, the wishes and choices stated by the individual, and to make the decisions consistent with the individual's previous decision making. And so, if decisions that are made start to look like they are not running along those lines, then there are processes to raise concern, and anyone can raise concern by contacting the family court. And there's actually a link that, there's a you can link into a form to complete with the family court to raise concern about the actions of an enduring power of attorney if you're really worried. My approach generally would be that I start off with education and support, and kind of make the assumption initially that people are making decisions that aren't so much in the best interests of the appointed person, the appointee, out of ignorance. So I make an effort to educate and remind people of their obligations under the Act, in the hope that that might just give them a little bit of a, we're watching you heads up without actually formally complaining in the first instance.
I think that's a good approach. You'd like to think that anyone who's been appointed as an EPLA would do their best, and sometimes it is just a lack of understanding.
And
Or
most do.
are there other, or are there other factors that are at play here that care a stress, or is there something else going on, and actually they just need a lot more support to be able
That's
to
right.
undertake this role?
So a
Because I'm
conversation
sure.
about, how are you doing, how is it going, is always a good way to start. But if that gets you nowhere or the concerns are really great, then yes, there's a process through the public, through the family court.
Well, I think that's us, team. So I will absolutely, I'll take those resources, and Suzanne has sent me a Word document with essentially a line out, a format of the information that you'd need to record in the notes or turn into a Word document if needed. So I think it's very reassuring that Suzanne has, very rarely do you say in medicine never or always. And so the fact that you have never been to court
Never,
in one of
never been to
these
court for a triple PNR application. So
reassuring.
there you go.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, for joining us this evening. And we really appreciate time. It's been very, very informative. And I am sure that everyone will be able to go forward with these with a lot more confidence, and maybe actually be able to enjoy the process versus fearing it. So thank you, everyone.
Lovely.
Thanks,
Thank you,
Suzanne.
everyone.
Thanks,
Have a good
Jan.
night.
Pleasure.